All right, hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled For the Love of Poetry, and it's about finding oneself in word and in words and all of that great stuff. And our guest is someone who knows something about finding oneself in poetry. Or knowing thyself within poetry, Miss Desi Bay, who you are a poet, you are putting this amazing edited collection together. Say something for yourself. Introduce yourself to the folks listening at home.
Hello, people. My name is Desi Bay. As Matt said, my current publication is called Know Thyself, An African-American Poetic Journey. It's an anthology that begins with ancient Kemet, better known as Egypt, ancient Egypt.
Well, why is it called Egypt and why isn't it called Kemet? See, well, that's the other way this works. I just give you softball questions. That's the first one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, actually, Kemet was the original name of ancient Egypt before Greek stole the legacy of the people.
Mm-hmm.
As the cradle of civilization is Africa, all the knowledge came out of Africa. Kemet is called the Black Land. And the bottom line is everything black was destroyed and turned into something maybe Grecian, the Greeks, or and then Egyptian.
Mm-hmm.
But however, the skin got lighter and lighter as the word Kemet disappeared.
Yeah.
And Kemet, to define it, is called the Black Land. It's defined as Black Land.
And so, and I think that's an important, you know, so we're already talking about, even in an ancient context, the kind of like cultural violence of colonialism, where not only are you, you know, sort of stealing physical things from people, or perhaps stealing people physically, but also then this erasure of culture and this erasure of identity, which is, in a weird way for me sometimes when I think about this legacy, the most violent. You know, I mean, physical violence on no person might die with the person, but what is it to erase a culture, history, identity?
Yeah. And it's caught, and even today, it's one of the reasons we have a problem with African Americans today, because they do not know their identity. Yeah. They have no roots to dig into to know what their past was.
Yeah.
You know, all they know basically is slavery.
Yes. And that Africa is a country.
And that Africa is a country.
Just one. Just
for
one.
Sure.
You
for
know,
sure.
I mean, it's something that I, you know, because I teach African American literature. I also teach African literature in my professional life. And I always have to have the, like, eye twitching, like, listen, everybody. Mm. Listen. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right now, I think it's in Africa. What is, I think, 62 or 63 UN member nations,
you know,
and within that probably 100 and I think 55 to 170 different ethnicities.
Right.
Yes. Second most populous continent on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Second most. Number two, we know Asians number one, and we, you know, in an American context, only think about Europe, but it's all there, and it's, I think, a luxury, right, that white folks can kind of get back to, oh, well, I'm Italian, we're going to have Italian days, we're going to have,
right,
you know, my Slavic mom's side of my family, you know, we have these weird cabbage-based religious holiday meals. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and it's
yeah.
like this preservation of this, but that cultural violence...
Mm-hmm. And the cultural violence is historic in itself.
Yes.
And even here in the United States, when we don't even want to recognize that slavery even existed or that it swept under the rug.
It was so long ago.
Oh, yeah.
So long ago.
But the effects are still felt today.
Yes, especially if you can't deal with it, you know.
And the guilt is, it still prevails, you know, the guilt and the, and even in Black folks, you know, we're in denial. A lot of us still in denial and don't want to speak of it. Mm-hmm. But, and I do feel that was the pain. It's the pain of it all. And that's why I found it necessary to publish this book. Know thyself.
You know. Which is, so it's a very positive thing, but then does embrace all of that negative history.
It does. I mean, because it has to come out until it's dealt with and reconciled with. It's going to be a problem. No matter how people try to sweep it under the rug, it's going to be a problem, especially for African Americans.
Yes.
Because until we get to know who we are, what can we give? What can we give our children? What's the legacy? You know, like you mentioned, you can go back to Italian culture. You can go back, you know, most African Americans can only go back to slavery if they don't have a teacher in their home. Because
if they don't have a teacher in their home, if they don't, you know, they're not on the Henry Louis Gates Junior show, PBS, which even then, I mean, I think that show actually brilliantly
it
demonstrates the problem that we have is that you get to a certain point and you think the slaves didn't even have names on the historical records.
Yeah.
You know, and you get the master's last name and that's it. And then that's a historical dead end. Mm-hmm. And it's an incredible act of denial, which actually starts, you know, Hegel in his, the super duper important foundational Western philosopher, German philosopher, Hegel in his mega philosophy of history, right? What does he say about Africa? He says, Africa has no history.
Hegel says this,
yes. Africa, no history, whatever.
The cradle of civilization.
But they didn't have opera, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is also this question of, which is something that, you know, I try to, as a cultural worker myself, try to wrap my head around, is this question of what, you know, when you think about the issue of culture and values, and what's the important work, and what's, you know, and what a potentially violent decision that can be as well. You know, putting, you know, an English professor putting a syllabus together, there can be violence in that.
There can be. There's violence all through history, especially American history.
Yeah.
Everything has been conquered. When you conquer something,
yeah,
it calls for violence.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not okay.
Yeah.
I mean, violence is not acceptable. Accepting people for what they are is what should be acceptable.
Yes.
You know, however, due to maybe the land that they live on, I can produce this in this land. I can get this from their earth.
Yeah.
You know, so we got to conquer this land. That means we got to kill a people.
Yeah.
That means we got to kill a people.
Or, you know, in grad school, in my kind of colonial lit courses, there was this great documentary that I need to probably pirate from that professor or something, or find out. It was called This Magnificent African Cake. And it was, you know, you think in Europe, there were all of the border skirmishes and the wars over religion and all of that. And it was right when that moment when ships got good enough, when naval navigation got good enough, and realizing that this treasure trove of resources was just...
Yeah.
And the King of Belgium said, you know, he brought, you know, the warring powers of Europe together and said, you know, why, you know, we just need to be careful and equitable in dividing up this magnificent African cake. Let's not kill each other to get all of this. Mm-hmm. And they were like, that's a good idea. you know, and these are people who kill each other, and then say, oh, well, you know, and let's divide it up as if nobody lived there.
Yeah, or they're all savages.
Yes, that is.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, there's a poem in the book called Middle Passage by Robert Hayden. And it's the story of the Amistad and the village they went to where they got Cinque. He was a king, and he came, and John Quincy Adams, I think, defended him in court once they got here. They took over a ship. But I think it was a Spanish ship, but they ended up here. They ended up here. It's a pretty long poem. I don't know if you want me to read this one.
Well, if you feel the spirit is moving you.
Well, I'd like to read one of the opening poems called...
Please do.
Called Know Thyself, and it's by Anthony T. Browder. And mind you, this is an anthology, so I'll have a few by other people than thyself. Now, this is the basis of the book. And this is to African Americans. It's simply called Know Thyself. A person who knows not and knows not that they know not is foolish. Disregard them. A person who knows not and knows that they know not is simple. Teach them. A person who knows not and believes that they know is dangerous. Avoid them. A person who knows and knows not that they know is asleep. Awaken them. A person who knows and knows not. A person who knows and knows that they know is wise. Follow them. All of these persons reside in you. Know thyself, and to may aught be true.
Nice. Which I think illustrating this dynamic we're talking about, perfectly commonsensical, but in the context of history and the way we've institutionalized knowledge, common sense, but also radical, right?
Correct.
Which is part of just the insanity of the world.
Correct.
Yes.
It's such an imbalance.
Yeah.
It's such an imbalance. And this poem is, Ma'at is a balance, you know? And the world is so imbalanced that I don't know what it's going to take, but we have to start in making things kind of right.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
And I think when you talk about reparations, people are afraid of reparations. Why? When even... foreign people have come to this land and got reparations.
Yeah.
You know, why cannot reparations for slavery be justified?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a couple. One is, well, there is just good old-fashioned racism. Okay, good old-fashioned, Which that exists, and right. I think we can say it. I think there's also this... one of the books that recently changed my life, right? Marita Sturkheim's Tourists of History, right? And it's about... well, okay, so the book... she was finishing up an academic reading of the gift shop at the Oklahoma City Memorial bombing. Mm-hmm. And she was probably finishing it up in the fall of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And then she had to write more book, basically. And, you know, and it's this very interesting question of like, well, okay, you have this spot of tragedy. What goes in the gift shop? And so, like, the introduction literally has, like, well, a reading of the snow globe that you can buy at the Oklahoma City bombing memorial.
Okay.
Where those kids died. Where that crazy white terrorist who was reading the Turner Diaries, which is this novel that predicts the race war, after a terrorist attack. But you can buy a snow globe there. And she says, you know, why is that? She says, because at least in the European mind, America always imagined itself as this post-historical place. This is where, you know, whether it was the Pilgrims or the Puritans or whatever, you know, I mean, Thomas More's utopia in 1516 was there's a new land and we can go there and fix all of our mistakes.
Right, right.
And how deeply ingrained is that in the sort of mainstream American consciousness that this is the place where shit doesn't happen and it didn't happen, and since there's not going to be suffering and tragedy and whatever... And she makes the argument in that book, and that's why when bad shit happens, she's thinking about it in the present tense. By the way, you can swear on this podcast if you want. When bad shit happens in the present tense, we don't know what to do as a nation. We totally freak out because this wasn't supposed to happen. How could this happen here? And if you have that identity, also then, what do you do with your history when you have all of the really terrible things that we are supposedly, you know, if America's the, if the new world is the reset button for humanity or whatever,
well, see,
what do you do when all the old garbage came with you?
Exactly. But we forget about the human, well, I wouldn't even say the course of events called karma.
Yeah.
You know, because America is not innocent.
No, it is
know?
Not.
And we understand that, you know, in life what goes around does come around, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So and what can you say about that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it is that, you know. In some people's mind, I always say, you know, they say if you've ever housebroken a dog, you know, if they do it on the carpet and you don't catch them within the first 5 minutes, they're not going to remember it was there.
Wow.
And I think, you know, mm-hmm. I'm just going to say it, you know, you think of like the Trump voter or whatever, the archetypal Trump, Cruz, Kasich, Republican voter. Who did that there? How did that happen? It was like that when, or it was like that when I got here. Which
correct.
Is the, you know, again, history is always this reset button, and nobody really thinks about, or most people don't think about, legacies and problems and whatever. That, yeah, so if you're the post-historical project.
Correct. And what do they really mean when they say they want America to be what it was in the past? Let's bring America back. What do they really want to occur?
When the 1950s. The 1950s. Which,
and that was good for who?
Well, middle-class white people?
Yeah.
Well, actually, men. I mean, you think even women, you know. You
exactly.
Think pre-Betty Friedan, The Feminine Mystique, which is itself a really exclusionary book in a lot of ways, you know. There was the problem with no name, as she called it.
Mm.
And I think about that as a metaphor for so much that sometimes, you know, sometimes troubles human beings, and especially perhaps American human beings, is, you know, if you can't even name it, if you can't even put it into words, if you can't even recognize it, you just have the crisis that lingers.
And that's it.
And that's it. And, you know, I think about, yes, 2016. By the way, you know, it's like over 200 days till the election. 200 days. We had 200 more days of
Trump.
Of this. Yeah.
Of this. In case of Ross Sarah. That's yeah. All, you know?
Yeah, you know, you just turn off the 24-hour news station. And,
yeah. But I do have a poem I want to share because I did put it on the internet earlier this morning.
Oh, I saw that. Yes.
Yeah.
It's on my live feed.
Yeah, it's a piece by Langston Hughes written in 1925, I think, and it's called Let America Be America Again. And I guess this is what they're calling for, but however. Now, this poem written in, it's on page 66.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm. This poem written in 1925 is still appropriate today because that's how poetry is. The truth never dies and never lies. So here it is. Let America be America again. Let it be the dream it used to be. Let it be the pioneer on the plain seeking a home where he himself is free. America never was America to me. Let America be the dream the dreamers dreamed. Let it be the great strong land of love, where never kings connive or tyrants scheme, that any man can be crushed by one above. It never was America to me. Oh, let my land be a land where liberty is crowned with no false patriot wealth, but opportunity is real and life is free. Equality is in the air we breathe. There's never been equality for me, nor freedom in this land, homeland of the free. Say, who are you that mumbles in the dark? And who are you that draws your veil across the stars? I am the poor, white, fooled, and pushed apart. I am the Negro bearing slavery scars. I am the red man driven from the land. I am the immigrant clutching and hoping I seek and finding only the same old stupid plan of dog eat dog, of mighty crush the weak. I am the young man full of strength and hope, tangled in the ancient endless chain of profit, power, gain, and grab the land, of grab the gold, of grab the ways of satisfying need, of work the men, of take the pay, of owning everything for one's own greed. I am the farmer, bondsman to the soil. I am the worker sold to the machine. I am the Negro, servant to you all. I am the people, humble, hungry, mean, hungry, yet today, despite the dream, beaten, yet today, pioneers. I am the man who never got ahead. The poorest worker, bartered through the years, yet I'm the one who dreamt our basic dream in the old world while still a serf of kings, who dreamt a dream so strong, so brave, so true, that even yet its mighty daring sings in every brick and stone, in every furrowed turn that's made America the land it has become. Oh, I'm the man who sailed those early seas in search of what I meant to be my home. For I'm the one who left dark Ireland's shore and Pola's plain and England's grassy lay, and torn from black Africa's strand I came to build a homeland of the free. The free. Who said the free? Not me. Surely not me. The millions on relief today, the millions shot down when we strike, the millions who have nothing for our pay, for all the dreams we've dreamed, and all the songs we've sung, and all the hopes we've held, and all the flags we've hung, the millions who have nothing for our pay, except the dream that's almost dead today. Oh, let America be America again, the land that never has been yet, and yet must be the land where every man is free, the land that's mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me. Who made America? Whose sweat and blood? Whose faith and pain? Whose hand at the foundry? Whose plow in the rain? Must bring back our mighty dreams again. Surely, call me an ugly name you choose. The steel of freedom does not stain. From those who live like leeches on the people's lives, we must take back our land again, America. Oh yes, I say it plain. America was never America to me. And yet I swear this oath, America will be. Out of the rack and ruin of our gangster death, the rape and rot of graft and stealth and lies, we, the people, must redeem the land, the mines, the plants, the rivers, the mountains, and the endless pain. All the stretch of these great green states, and make America again.
Yes. Very still relevant today.
Isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
And now, how far have we come to go back to 1925 and this is still relevant?
Well, I mean, I think maybe what we're hitting on is, you know, the Trump voter might think that poem is un-American. I think that's the most American and, in a way, in a weird way, patriotic thing ever. Because the Trump voter doesn't really love America, but is infatuated by this idea of America. To truly love something that you understand its mm-hmm. flaws, its shortcomings, and you still have an investment in it.
Right. Right.
And, yeah, I mean, is this the uniquely American kind of core short circuit that are we still trying to overcome?
Yeah.
This notion, this mythology, you know, and it is this, what is, you know, something like the American dream, what is the cost of that? What is the mythology of that? And how can poetry reclaim that space? Because I think I like what you said before, this idea of poetry, you know, and truth never dies. You know, is there something about poetry that is uniquely positioned to reclaim this sense of history, identity, and truth that, you know, you're not going to get on Fox News. I don't think you can get it on 24-hour news at all, ever.
But there is. Because it leaves it up to the hearer to move. We're not saying, this is poetry. You accept it as it is. It's not truth. It's not false. It simply is stating a heartfelt sensitivity.
Sensitivity, yeah.
You know? And we all feel it.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. If we can go with our feelings, I think it would be a better world if we stayed in tune with our humanity.
Which makes me wonder, is it that maybe our problem is, do we think in prose? You know, and because for me, there's like, you know, because I do a little bit of writing too, a little bit, a very small amount. And I think about sometimes the things for me that become poems are the things that I can't write in prose. It's a different consciousness for me.
It definitely is.
You know, and is that, you know, is then poetry in this collection sort of uniquely positioned or a unique experience to say, aha, well, if you, you know, 24-hour news is a way of seeing the world and the essay is a way of seeing the world.
Definitely.
There is a unique opportunity here with these poems and this collection of poems to open up a door that needs to be open or needs to be recognized. And
yes.
Yeah.
And so a healing can begin.
Yeah.
You know, I think most people living in America is scarred in some kind of way. It seems.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like we're angry people. A lot of us, you know,
I think we're angry. We're hurt. We're scared. I think we're incredibly insecure.
Exactly. You know? And a healing has to take place, and the fear has to cease, you know?
Yeah.
And the paranoia has to cease, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there is this. Yeah, you're right.
You know, Reagan tore down a wall, and, you know, we're getting ready to build a wall.
We're going to build the wall. Oh, Lord.
You know, how American is building a wall.
Yeah. Well, again, I think if you're infatuated, if you can't deal with the ambivalence of America and the complexity of America, like that poem does.
And that's what it is. Very complex.
Yeah.
And it touches on everything, you know. And you know, it brings me to the issue of diversity also. I do have, you know, as much as I love humankind and human beings, I have a problem with diversity only because, as an African American, I think it again crushes us and leaves us on the bottom of the totem pole without a doubt. Okay. Let's raise, the nationality levels. I mean, well, you can't, you know, let's bring everybody in. It's a melting pot. But however, we've been here how many years and haven't gotten reparations. We can't pull ourselves up by our bootstraps because there's simply no straps.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing to pull it together, you know, because there's everybody comes to our community. You have the gentrification of the communities. They come and they build, we buy. We have, why can't as Black people, we be producers? We have I don't want to say it's our history. I'll say a stereotypical historic reference as, you know, maybe we can't get a loan because they don't pay our bills. But the truth is our interest is so much higher than everybody else's.
Yes.
And it's still that way.
And your homeowner's insurance.
It's so much higher than everyone else's.
Yeah.
You know, and it's sad to think, I mean, this was going on in the Jim Crow era, but it's still going on now.
It's happening in the city we are in right now.
Yeah.
In some really violent and weird ways, you know. I guess that's the thing, too, is you think, you know, it's the, you know, Let's talk about some... Well, you know, Trump was here last night. Oh, we'll say that for folks listening. Trump was in our town last night. You know, the whole mythology of him, right? He's a successful businessman and all of that. And actually, it was the Financial Times, I believe, who did a thing where, you know, because he got $1 million loan. He's a self-made person who got $1 million loan.
Now, how about that? How does that work? How does that work?
How does that work, you know? Yeah. And what they pointed out was, you know, because he's declared bankruptcy 4 times. Because he's allowed to do that. Because he can afford those lawyers. If he took that $1 million, and instead of being a developer and a businessman who gets the deal done, he just put it in an annuity that followed the S&P 500, right? Mm. That just followed the market, didn't beat the market, and did nothing since, like, 1974, he'd be richer than he is today.
Wow. Wow.
You know, it's not that he's that smart, but he can afford to be stupid. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that is.
But what does that say about the mentality of the people who hear him?
Because you want to be that person. I mean, I'm sure it's a bit of narcissism. It's a bit of, it's mythology. It's all mythology. It's not, you know, it's not fact. It's not truth. It's a belief in a worldview that does not compute. I think that's a lot of what's happening. I think a lot of that anger, you know, and at least thankfully the open carry people, because I don't know if you knew about that. There was an email that was going around that there was going to be people that were going to meet by the old Forbes Field wall, about 50 people with AK-47s.
No, I didn't hear that.
Yes, that emails went out on the Oakland listservs that, you know, there might be people walking around with AK-47s and whatever to police this. I mean, it was apparently it was a hoax, but it scared the shit out of people. And, and I know people who didn't. I was grading, really. But I know other people who were going to go to the rally who were like, oh, you know, I don't want to get into, I don't want to get shot, you know.
Exactly.
Kind of thing. So, but this went out that this was going to have these people. And you think, like, why do you take up guns to patrol the streets of an American city? I think it's because your worldview is dying, broken, and no longer exists and can't...
Exactly.
It does not compute anymore. Exactly. And it's something is bending in people till it is completely broken.
I agree with that.
And either there's going to be some kind of... The hopeful me thinks that there's just going to be some kind of, like, epistemological rupture for people, and they're just gonna, like, come out of the wreckage and go, oh, this is how the world works. Or, you know, if that man doesn't get elected, what kind of Oklahoma cities are we gonna have?
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know,
that's something to think of.
That's a scary thing to think about, but that's out there. And I think that's a real threat. I mean, that's, I think, people's angst. It's not just that, you know, and I think people express it in, oh, well, yeah, Trump's a horrible human being and he says really stupid things all the time. But what, that's almost a metaphor for this really scary belief system that, again, I think is a very American belief system.
Exactly.
We haven't dealt with it.
And that's it. Again, it's very frightening that this is the American belief system. And as in that poem, Let America Be America Again, you know, too many people buy into that mentality that is, you call it mythical, but it's somebody's reality.
Yeah.
It's somebody's reality. And it's fear. I think it's a lot of it is based on fear and lack of, you know, how can you have lack of... self-esteem as almost a nation of people, you know?
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I think a lot of that is, you think, I mean, one of the things I will say about that, let's go back to the 1950s thing, is, you know, at least for some people, you know, because of those damn unions, you know, which of course those people hate, you know, there was financial stability for people. I mean, I think about, you know,
for some people.
I mean, if me and my father were born 10 years later, my father, I was just telling a coworker this, My father worked for IBM for 35 years. Mm-hmm. And in 1987, when they got into a crisis, they gave all of those people, all of my people, my dad's age, my dad was 55, mm-hmm. Early retirement. And he was able to live the rest of his life in a pension, and he had stock options.
How about
and
that? All
yeah.
How about that? What's that today? That.
Yeah, what's that today? If it was 10 years later, if it was 1997, he would have just been laid off and unemployable at 55, mm-hmm. and I wouldn't have gotten the education that I got, and I wouldn't be where I am today. Mm-hmm. Just 10 years. I mean, it's a weird thing for me at 38 thinking about all the doors that have closed behind me.
Isn't that something?
And it's a weird thing, and I worry about the young people I work with and deal with, you know. Like, what really? And so I think there's a core of that belief, mythology, you know, a new Levittown house, thank you, Housing Act of 1948, which was also a profound act of white supremacy and all of that. Mm-hmm. A new Levittown house, if a man was working and was a union worker, the down payment in 1955 in a Levittown house was two paychecks for a brand new house in mm-hmm. the suburbs, the ultimate wow. American dream.
Wow.
That's not something that would be available. That's not something available to today. Most of today's college mm-hmm. graduates.
Yeah, they usually end up back home with their parents.
Because they're in debt and yeah. all yeah. of that, you know. And so, but you think those people, at least while we were scared of them Russians and all them other people, at least financially, there was probably some kind of, mm-hmm. and we actually had this thing called Social Security, and we believed in it, and we knew yeah. that it would be there for us, you know. Mm-hmm. We had, you know, what, two decades later, a minimum wage that actually met inflation, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm all down for the fight for 15, but actually, if it met inflation, minimum wage would be $22.10.
How about that?
You know?
Yeah. But unfortunately, I think America kind of thrives on downtrodden people. I mean, it's a thing called capitalism.
You beat me to that punch, yeah.
You know? It's a thing called capitalism. And that's, you know, the rich do get richer and the poor get poorer. And that's an American way. Unfortunately, how do we survive? How does one survive? You know, if yeah. it's not from a family legacy. Yeah. If... You know, it's got to be from the family legacy.
Yeah. Well, you think for all of those years, you know, there's the idea that the answer to stagflation in the 70s was suppressing wages. You know, mm-hmm. so when St. Reagan fired all the air traffic controllers
right.
and broke that union, you know, well, we'll suppress wages and the capital will get flowing again. Mm-hmm. And as David Harvey pointed out once, you know, well, how do people get around that? Get out your credit cards, cash in the equity in your home.
Mm.
All of that stuff to sort of undo that imbalance. You know, we don't maybe also part of this crisis, because I think money is a great lubricant for a lot of people. It's a, yes. it's a social lubricant.
Definitely.
It's a lubricant in interpersonal relationships and families, but also as a society. Well, we don't have that, or at least we know that, you know, credit or whatever is scary. Mm-hmm. And so then what are we left with? I don't know, something, we'll bring it back. We'll bring it back. We'll bring something back. It'll be, yeah. we'll get all the cool stuff, and it won't be in any way all the stuff that's ideologically troubling for us. No, we're going to bring it back.
Yeah, right. We're going to bring back Reagan politics, right?
Well, I think we're still there. I think that's the problem, is we haven't moved yeah. away. Bring back the New Deal.
Yeah, hey, how about that?
New Deal 2, the sequel.
I do remember when Reagan was elected, and one of the things he did, he closed down all these mental institutions. Mm-hmm. And that's all these people are out on the street with no place to go.
Yeah.
There's so much mental illness in so many communities that goes untreated. Yeah. You know, and now we have this violent community. I mean, we're back in, you know, barbaric days. The way, you know, the yeah. violence is horrible.
Yeah.
You know, and I do. I take it all the way back to Reagan whenever he closed the mental institutions. Mm-hmm. There was, you know, and to be honest, the welfare system in Pennsylvania, at that time, we had one of the best welfare systems. I know people who would leave other states to come here and live because of the welfare system. But however, he cut the men off. He cut the men off, the males off the welfare system. And so they had to take to the streets, and that's when gangs became prevalent in Pittsburgh, yeah. Pennsylvania, at that yeah. point in time. And, you know, it's sad, but it's true. But the bottom line is the knowledge of yourself. You know, we're back to the poetry of it all.
Well, I think this is an important thing of, yeah, reclaiming history and speaking that truth, if not to power, at least to community.
Exactly.
And to oneself, even.
Exactly. And once you know who you are and you grasp a history of yourself, you have something to bank tomorrow on. You know,
yeah.
I know I can be this. You know, my father was this. You know, even if I'm fatherless or I don't know who my dad is,
yeah.
I know my ancestors, yeah. you know, were this.
Yeah. And it also is an amazing way of thinking about the future then, too, right? I mean, there is this issue
Definitely.
Of legacy then.
Definitely. Definitely.
You know, what does one carry forward? What does one need to preserve? What mm-hmm. does one need to exist?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a spirit. It's a spirit, you know. It's so challenging. I mean, just everyday life, you know, surviving. Mm-hmm. It's so challenging. But the fact that you have a victorious spirit to overcome mm-hmm. so many things, and you only know it if you know your history.
Yeah.
You know, and I must say, one of the reasons I wrote this, I started this book, I was doing timelines for African History Month at different elementary schools, high schools.
Oh.
So it was a timeline, and the book is set up as a timeline also. But I was in the presence of Jesse Jackson at one point, and he held up a Bible. He said, "This is the history of the Israel people. Someone needs to document the history of African Americans,
mm-hmm.
how their Red Sea was open, you
yeah.
know, how God brought them through,
yeah.
and they still survive today."
Yeah.
So that just gave me confirmation, okay, I may be doing this, you know, like in oral presentations, but it needs to be written.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, you know, I invested a little bit and got it published, and I'm glad that I did, you know, and I
yeah.
thought I was done. I said, okay, I did this. I can relax because it took me 10 years,
to choose
the poems, you know, and to
wow.
get the copyright permission from everybody.
Everybody,
wow. Yeah, yeah, that was a search. You know, that was a headache, but nevertheless.
<My Lord.
laughs> Yeah, and when I got it done, I said, okay, I'm done. I can relax. And then someone said, oh, no. Now you have to write another book to say why you chose these particular poems and these particular authors.
Yes, exactly. That, which actually was the question I was going to ask. In terms of, for you then, what was it like, your mental process, your feelings, putting this together, this long journey? What did this do to you? What were there discoveries that you made, or, you know, because I think that's the thing. I know, like, working on a big project like that, it's just...
Yeah.
You know, at worst, it's the elephant at the very least, it's the elephant in the room, right? It's
yeah.
like, what's that in the corner? Oh, that's the book project. You know, it's this almost way of like this huge
yeah.
castle on your mental landscape, and you can't look around it.
Yeah.
What did that do to you for 10 years of kind of thinking about this, putting this forward, thinking, you know, what parts of this identity, what parts of this experience?
Anguish. And yeah. it was grueling, anxiety. Slavery is always a part, you know, where you feel the pain. I do have two slave narratives in here also
mm-hmm.
From the Federal Writers Project. But I could never write a poem about slavery. And I always admire people who could go back, poets who can do that. But that was the most intensive, heartfelt, painful part, and getting past that, everything else was kind of okay. I knew this happened, I knew that, I heard this before, but the pain and the cruelty of chattel slavery, you know, it just dug deep, you know. And if we go back to Roots, if you watch Roots and you see how cruel, I mean, they left no stone unturned there, but
yeah.
imagine that being done to how many people, a nation of people,
millions,
you know? Yeah. You know, it's that was the most grueling part. You know, I would put the book down in stages of that and say, okay, I'll pick this up later. I'll pick this up later. And then finally it was enough, you know, and There's poems by a poet called, her name is Frances Harper, and it's called The Auction Block, about a mother seeing her son being sold on an auction block. You know, to imagine those things, you know.
Yeah.
You know, and for the white person, the white man to see, okay, these people have no feelings. They have no heart. These are animals. And, you know, the men didn't wear pants. They wore shirts, but they weren't allowed to wear pants. Yeah. They ate out of troughs, like, you know, like animals.
Yeah.
You know, those things, you know, it's like, you know, it's sad, it hurts, and it still hurts.
Yeah.
You know, to think that another human being, well, they didn't consider us human being. We were simply chattel. And that didn't happen to any other nation of people. Even though there was slavery around the world, nobody lost their identity but us.
Yeah.
But African Americans, you know, we'll say African Americans, unless you do your, you know, your search, you don't know what country you came from in Africa, unless you, you know, but nevertheless, no one lost their identity but us. And that, I think that that's a painful thing also. Not knowing who you are, That hit me the hardest, especially that poem about losing her son, you know.
Yeah.
Watching that.
Yeah. Which is, again, I mean, I think, is that then the most violent of all the violence?
Yes.
I mean, that is like a metaphysical violence. Mm-hmm. And it also, for me, it makes me think about what is it then, you know, in terms of the role of culture and what it means to be human.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and how we need all of these things.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like white folk are still in denial that this history happened. You know, it has to be reckoned with. It really has to be reckoned with for America to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, for diversity to really be diverse.
Yeah.
It really has to be reckoned with.
I mean, that was her thing. I mean, I never thought in my lifetime, and the magic and horror of Facebook and the magic of blocking people, you know, I would see in my timeline, you think in 08, 09, 010, you know, when I about had enough, that we would have almost an open debate in this country of whether or not the good guys won the Civil War. You know what I mean? There's a violence to stupidity as well. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And I couldn't wrap my head around that would suddenly get back on the table in a mainstream way.
And here it is, 2016.
2016, and we're still struggling with that and legacy and. Is it also a metaphor for, you know, we have this dog, I think it goes back to the Langston Hughes poem, we have this dog-eat-dog culture. Anywhere you are, right, we also have this hyper-individualistic culture where you got it, and you don't want to think about maybe how you might have been born on second base, or if your parents can give you a million-dollar loan, you were born on third base. You didn't hit a triple.
You were born there. Yeah.
You were born there.
Yeah, you were born
there. And people
there.
Don't like to think about
that
in our culture about achievement and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you do then with legacies? And what do you do, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where, you know, there's not a lot of undeveloped land in the East End. I bought this house. I played the East End of Pittsburgh real estate game. And from what I'm hearing from people who are buying and selling this year, if a house has been on the market for more than a week, there's something wrong with it.
Wow.
You know, it's that crazy.
It's that crazy. I mean,
you know, there's Homewood and Hazelwood and Larimer.
The flatlands.
The flatlands.
No,
the Poland of Pittsburgh real estate.
What,
you know, I mean, the East Liberty, the towers. Yeah. I mean, four podcasts ago, we had on Robin Clark, who is a professor at Pitt, who was talking about, you know, the Penn Plaza apartments, you know. That's to put in a Costco. They're kicking all those people out.
To put in a Costco.
That's the rumor, that's the plan, you know. What do you do? I mean, that is, again, just, oh, more violence.
More violence. More violence.
But Pittsburgh is America's most livable city, you know.
So they say, yeah.
So they say, for if you count, you know, parks and the symphony and,
and the
really
cultural
trendy
district.
And really trendy, expensive restaurants.
Right.
We're the best, you know.
And then they're moving the city dwellers out to the suburbs and cutting the buses.
Yeah, no,
you know,
that
cutting
is...
the bus lines, you know?
Yeah.
No, bus service. Okay, so we're taking your house. We're moving you out of your apartment that you're living in because we want this land to develop. You're going way out here in the suburbs. And guess what?
You're
there's
gonna
no
be stuck
public,
there. Yeah.
There's no public transportation.
And then wonder why people are poor and bad things happen.
Right.
You know, right. If you... I guess there's that thing, like, we don't think about institutions, support systems, the infrastructure that everybody needs to live. There's this, like, there's those things that we see, and then there's things we just choose not to see.
Yeah.
And we don't even know how they work. And, but we see how when people don't have those things, we don't ascribe it to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, you can't drink the water in Flint, Michigan. You know, I mean, how insane is that? That, you know,
yeah,
there are parts of this country that cannot get tap water right.
Yeah. How did you even get to that? You know, one thing I heard that General Motors had
GM had warned them. They said, this is messing with our stuff. We need to go back to Detroit Water.
Right.
We're not going to be able to build these cars. And that was more valid than human beings. Yeah, I mean, it's... You know, it's one of those things that, you know, every ideology, every mythology is an act of omission. And I think one of the things that I find interesting about how Christian theology has changed in my lifetime is idolatry is like one of those sins that doesn't count anymore. You just wave that one off. You just wave that one off, you know. I don't know. I don't even know what that means. I don't know. And, you know, imagine if even just something like that was still a mainstream idea in people's minds.
And it
how do you stuff. How do you get around that? What kind of mental gymnastics do you do to get past that then? You know, because that's what a lot of, I think, contemporary American crazy is this kind of weird mental gymnastics.
You're kind of right.
You know, but yeah, idolatry. I don't count that. It's like the neighborhood playing baseball. You know, which I guess they got rid of that, you know. The foot's never really on second base in the double play, but it's close enough. The throw beat the runner. Were the, you know,
I hear what you're saying.
Kind of thing. You know, what do we do with that?
Yeah, that's why you need poets. Yeah. That's exactly
well,
why
that's,
you need
that's
poets.
Why you need poets. That's why you need to disrupt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was actually just recently a Pennsylvania politician in terms of educational funding wanted and higher ed funding did say, and imagine what party he was in, I forget his name, that, you know, we need to get rid of the Walmart majors. We need, if people want to go study poetry and then work at Walmart and be poor, you know, we need to unfund that. We need to get rid of that. Everybody's got to, you know, be productive with their education.
Robotic. How robotic can you be?
Yeah. What a you know, you still have profound human need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess that's the other thing too, is I think the power of culture, you know, I think there's elite high art, which serves the function of culture,
mm-hmm.
and then there's shitty entertainment. And we have a lot of shitty entertainment in this country.
For sure.
And a lot of people who need culture, you know, who need that, like, those things that, those emotional things, those historical things that can be fulfilled in people. It's almost, is like, I mean, it's weird to think, I think about this moment in history, I think about the young people I work with, and if it freaks me out sometimes to think that you can have actually a culture, a landscape, a way the world works that's actually hostile to human interests.
Now, how about that?
And that, and I think in a lot of ways that's where we are. And I think for me it's emotionally distressing if I think about that too much.
Yeah, you're right, because you know, most politicians are saying, hey, I don't give a damn about the people. This is the way it's going to be.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to go over here and I'm going to make Kim Jong-un disappear over in Korea, right?
Yeah.
What you do, you know what you're going to set off when you do that.
Yeah.
You know, as much as I love President Obama, I think it was a catastrophe. What happened with Gaddafi?
He said it now. He said that was his big mistake.
Did he actually?
He said that biggest mistake of his presidency, which actually was Hillary Clinton's idea. But anyway.
Oh, okay. Let the cat out the bag.
Yeah, I think a lot of that was, you know, that was her State Department. Who do I like for that election? Who am I going to voting for in a couple weeks? You know, yeah. I mean, wow. I think Libya was a catastrophe. I think drone warfare is a catastrophe.
It is.
I mean, you know, when you blow up a wedding party and you count every male over the age of 14 as an enemy combatant, you know, I mean, that's a way you can calculate a way bureaucratically. That's bureaucratic evil. If you just, oh, well, that just doesn't count.
No, every human life counts. It counts.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. That's the world we live in. And it's, if I think about it too much, it you know, freaks me out, but it's there. And it's I think that's one of the other unfortunate things about our culture and consumerism. Painful truth?
Yeah.
Or pleasantry or fast food or Applebee's. You know what I mean? Like you can deal with slavery or you can get cheese fries at Applebee's.
Well, you know what? The cheese fries are gonna clog your arteries.
Yeah.
The truth, it's been said over and over, will set you free.
The truth will set you free.
It will set you free.
The truth is probably vegan. I don't know. Sorry, a couple podcasts ago, I had a vegan peace punk band on, and they were great. And
really?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, their record's coming out. Band Silence, for those of you who are regular listeners of the podcast, and their record is going to come with a booklet of political writings about peace and punk and humanity forward. So you get a punk album with essays and a bibliography to go read stuff.
That sounds great.
That's kind of amazing, yeah. I mean, you know, maybe that's, you know, Henry Giroux calls that public pedagogy.
Henry Giroux?
Henry Giroux is an educational theorist scholar who says that, you know, pop culture is a form of education. And we have to look at the values that are being instilled in people through pop culture.
And you really
because
do.
That's more powerful than what happens in the classroom, unfortunately. And people spend more time with it and more invest in it. So can you also then flip it around and can you make instructive pop culture and public pedagogy?
We must. Yes. We must, because what's going on in the classrooms has been going on since, what, the 1950s?
Oh, before, again, we go back, let's go back to Hegel saying, you know? Africa has no history.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there is that, I mean, Edward Said's book, Orientalism, you know, where he talked about, again, Egypt.
Or yeah, Kemet.
Kemet, that the idea that he said, you know, the Western idea of the East, he says in this book, Orientalism, really began when then Napoleon conquered Egypt.
Ah, there you go.
And sent scholars in to study those people.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you're sending scholars in to study a conquered people, what you're not going to talk about how great they are, or the value of their culture.
Exactly.
And he said that in a lot of ways, the Western way of looking at the East as the West's other, as the West's inferior.
Mm-hmm.
Started with that, and he talks about how many of those myths are still ingrained in the Western psyche. Which, by the way, speaking of the legacy of slavery, did you hear about the University of Virginia study of their med students?
No.
Okay. They polled 222 med students about ideas of race and pain tolerance and skin thickness. And there is at least one med student in a major accredited med school program that does not believe that people of African descent are capable of feeling pain.
See?
Think about that. I mean, and that is, of course, a myth rooted in slavery.
Exactly.
Yes. And while there's one person who believes that extreme idea, there was a large trend of pre-service doctors who thought that while the darker skin pigment is mm-hmm. about thickness mm-hmm. and the lack of nerve endings.
See? Yeah.
That those myths actually triumph medical science for some mm-hmm. doctors. That's insane.
It's insane.
That's insane. And that is a legacy. And you think, like, how does that work its way from pre-1865 to 2016? How does that survive?
How does it survive? See?
You know,
racism. Yeah. It's a way of life for some people.
Yeah.
You know?
And
it's
sadly, for a lot of people, and because it's institutionalized, sadly, those people don't even know that it's a way of life.
Exactly.
It's just life.
Yeah, it's just life.
It's not a skin that you can strip mm-hmm. yourself of and go live in a yeah. more interesting, happier world.
Exactly.
You know? That's the weird thing about those Trump people. They can't be having fun. They can't be having fun.
Anything that causes this much unrest and violence could not be edifying.
Yeah.
It could not be edifying.
It's a desperate lunging attempt of a dying worldview. I mean, that's the thing. As much as I have Trump anxiety, I try to remind all of my friends, you know, the Republican Party has won one national election, one popular vote in a national election since 1988. That was Bush in 2004.
Wow.
Is Trump really the guy who's going to break that streak?
Do you think?
No. I don't think he can. I think there is enough, even folks who don't realize, you know, or won't even willing to have a conversation about white privilege or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's enough decent people in the world. I just can't.
Dude, we pray.
He's not the guy to break that streak. Yeah. It needs to be another Ronald Reagan, who is just a friendly, bumbling grandpa who liked jelly beans in the Oval Office. I remember at like 4 years old knowing the president liked jelly beans and thinking that guy was all right.
Who was really president during, because it couldn't have been him. Who was behind the scenes?
Who was behind the scenes, especially towards the end?
Yeah, we have to research that.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, but yeah, it can't be Trump. It's not going to be Trump. It's not going to be Trump. And by 2020, because of demographics, Texas will be a blue state, which means possibly we will never see another Republican president in our lifetimes. And that could legitimately happen. That is my, don't call it naive optimism.
Mythology.
Mythology. But, yeah, they won, for all of their bluster, they've won one national election since 1988.
Wow, I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, and it was 2004. It was Bush 2004. Mm-hmm. And you think if...
And that's the recount in Florida.
That's the Florida recount. And no, that's 2000 was the Florida recount.
Okay.
2004 was voting machine shenanigans in Cleveland.
The punch.
Well, no, what happened in Cleveland, Ohio in 2004, a lot of people just talk about history people don't talk about. They passed a law that every polling place, whether it was a town of 50 people or an inner city neighborhood in Cleveland, would have the exact same number of voting machines. Mm-hmm. So rural Ohioan voters would go and have zero weight.
I remember now.
I believe there were people like handing out sandwiches, bottled water, and mason jars to folks to try to keep folks in line. And though Bush was losing Ohio by 6 points the day before, he carried Ohio and carried the election. But that was the one time, and everybody was scared out of their minds, that a Republican, since 88, that a Republican won a national election popular vote. Once.
Wow.
Is it really going to be Trump?
It can't be.
It is, I think, is a matter of perspective and mm-hmm. the things, you know. That's one of the things Allen Ginsberg, about the 1950s, said, you know, it was a schizophrenic time. Mm-hmm. There are those truths, those things that people lived and knew about.
Yes.
And observed in their everyday lives and what people were allowed to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that's interesting, at least in our times, mm-hmm. is that I see that coming around again, where I think you have, whether it's a media, whether it's a sense in people's heads what the national conversation mm-hmm. should be versus the truths people know inside themselves. And I think we're experiencing that schizophrenia and unbalance. And, I mean, things rumble. And
hopefully it dies out. This is an older culture that is dying.
Yeah.
You know, this is. I hope this is the last stand.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah.
Wouldn't this be
the last stand?
Well, you know, somebody pointed out that the Trump campaign office in Monroeville just happens to be at the same place those discount bus trips to Atlantic City drop off. It's like right near, and somebody, a friend of mine on Facebook, was like, that's not an accident.
No, it's not. It's not.
It's not an accident. They know their demographic. And wow. It is these people who are hurt, scared, alienated, mm-hmm. you know, who don't understand or trust or want to live in the world. And those of us who hopefully do, or I try to live in the world, I'm having a lot more fun than those people.
Yeah.
I'm having a lot richer experience.
I am also.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's with the truth being told and accepting it as it is, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm not angry. I'm not mad at you. You know, but this is what it is, you know?
This is what it is.
This is what it is.
Yeah.
You know?
So do you have any of your own poetry in this collection?
Of course.
Could you, before we get to the bottom five, could you read us one of your poems?
Okay, well, how about one called Reparations Now?
Okay, fantastic. Let's do it.
Okay. You know, usually before I write, you know, writing is something I love to do, but I usually search and try to find something that's written already. And if I find that it's written, I don't bother. I just read. I read other people's poems. I don't have no problem with
somebody already invented that wheel.
Exactly. Let me move on. But there was a reparation poem that I did like, but the person's wife wouldn't give me copyright permission, so I had to write one. So I did. And here it is. It's simply called Reparations Now. O King of Nations, New World Order, Houdini of the Universe, exposed. If the English came from England, Irish came from Ireland, Polish came from Poland, why do you think we should deny Africa? Reparations Now. You know it should be. For the Negro Leagues, number 42, your chosen one, pleasing your crowds, roar, while still he had to enter through the back door. For Robert Johnson at the crossroads, the blues, the whole blues, and nothing but the blues you singing now. For Uncle Ben representing white rice, and whose auntie is Aunt Jemima anyway? Reparations Now. For the baby girls four on a Birmingham sanctified Sunday, for the mix of mixed up non-violence, non-cis believers justified, for the privilege and pale face, the intentional smallpox blanket swaddled in your gift to the natives of this land. Reparations Now. For the miseducation of the Negro, nigger, coloreds, Afro-Americans, black niggas, African-Americans, for the many unnamed Amistads, for the stilling of virginity, for all the Kunta Kintes and illegitimate bastard Tobies, for the raping of manhood, for the whelps on our backs, still bleeding, still bleeding, still bleeding, for strange fruit hanging from the poplar tree, burning, 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 for Emmett Till, then and now, reparations, now, for the ghetto and projects, COINTELPRO's last slip of heroin, cocaine, and crack into my community. This is my house and I live here. Reparations now. For the soul music extracted from our spirit. For the coolness stolen at will. For the thick lips and apple hips and all the wannabes you became. And on, for insufficient funds. And on, and on, and on, for the Tuskegee experiment. And on, no extension granted. Interest, package, and handling fees come due. What about the 40 acres? Real estate. What about that mule? Make it real. Multiply to quantify a nation of people. And what of forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors? Oh, King of Nations, Houdini of the Universe, for your kingdom crimes, we will not bow. You got yours, they got theirs. Reparations now.
There's no way that other poem was better than that. There's no way. That was, wow.
Thank you.
Wow. It couldn't have been. No, that's the best. That's it. Folks, I'll have a link on the website when I post this. How do people get this collection? How do people...
Well, we'll put the link on that.
We'll put the link on the
website. Also, there's lulu.com.
Okay.
LULU.com. You can go there, look up Know Thyself, an African American poetic journey. Yeah. Or just Google my name.
Just Google your name.
All right. It's on Amazon. It's also on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Yes.
There you go. I'll put a link to the Amazon store and all of that.
Yes.
Okay. It's now time for the bottom five. A series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready?
Are we ready? Will I ever be ready?
All right, no one's ever ready for the bottom five.
Bring it on.
All right, question one. If reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease or illness would you be? Like if
I'd be diabetes.
You'd be diabetes?
Because I love sugar. I want to be the ice cream man. I want to be the ice cream
You
want to
be the ice cream? There you go. You could be the ice cream disease.
I'll be the ice cream disease.
All right. That was easy. So question two. If you had to choose, would you welcome the total elimination of day or night?
It would have to be night. It would have to be night. Eliminate the night because, actually, I have a problem seeing at night.
There you go. That's very practical.
That's physical. That's a physical thing. As you get older, you know, you get kind of, okay, where's that yellow line? I'm driving here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's the whole growing food thing, too. It's important.
Who thought about it? We do need light, sunshine.
To grow food, yeah. I mean, I always think that would be a great job-creating industry.
Mm-hmm.
If the sun burned out, the artificial light industry, I mean... All those manufacturing jobs would have to come back. And hopefully they'd be union jobs and it'd be all good.
Wow. You know, speaking of union jobs, not to get off the subject, but with the, everybody fighting for a wage increase, I find my, a lot of coworkers who I thought were, kind of fair. Well, if they go up to $15 an hour, I definitely have to get a raise. Okay, I'm not thinking on why. Here we go. Now there's going to be a class struggle here.
There's going to be a class struggle and there's an elitism,
Yeah.
There's, they work at what they do.
Yeah.
So, those people work really freaking hard. It's okay. They should be allowed to eat. Question three. I'm changing it up. I had a different one chosen, so here it is. Have you ever had a dream you wish you could revisit or a dream world you wish you could periodically revisit from time to time? Was there a dream you wish you could go back to?
And to be continued, I used to be able to do that when I was so in tune with the universe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was a time I, mysticism and all that stuff, but... Is there a dream? Yeah, I would love to live a fairy tale for once. what princess would I be? I don't know, but I would like to be a princess, live in a castle and have a king and have servants. And then, I would love to live that, but I would be a kind queen. Everybody would have, even my servants would have the best. So, whatever. We live happily ever after. Thanks. But I don't know if that's what you're looking for, but that's what I'm giving you.
It's good enough. Question four.
It's not so philosophical.
Philosophical.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. So this actually also isn't very philosophical, and it's not even a question, it's a prompt.
Oh.
Could you tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory of your childhood? And so what I'm thinking about that is not like, we went to Disney World, but it mm-hmm. rained that day and mm-hmm. we made cookies.
I don't know. Repeat that question.
So it says, tell me a happy but somewhat unremarkable memory of your childhood. something that wasn't like this special super duper occasion mm-hmm. happened, but there was this memory of something that was perhaps particularly pleasant mm-hmm. that was just sort of ordinary.
I'm thinking, okay, pleasant or
but somewhat unremarkable.
Well, probably. Okay, it would probably be my first pair of glasses.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I was in the fourth grade. And finally, I could see the board.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
I could see the board, and everything took on new meaning because, I mean, the colors, everything was more pronounced.
Wow.
And who knew I needed glasses?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And why I wasn't getting my math problems right because I couldn't see the board.
The board, yeah.
So it made all the difference in my life.
Yeah. Which is also, I think, a metaphor for our main conversation. How do people, if they're not seeing right, know they're not seeing right?
How about that?
There we go. We're almost closing the loop, but we have one more question. So unfortunately, we're not. But we might close the loop on this one, too. This is the Christopher Hitchens question. Mm-hmm. In honor of him and his book, Mortality, when he found out that he had cancer, he talked about the, you know, obituaries he was looking forward to reading that he would never read. And then he said, wait, no, I wanted to write their obituaries. So of the living, this has to be someone who's alive, the living villains of history, whose obituary would you like to write? If you got the call from, you know, the New York Times or whatever, whose obituary would you like to write of the living villains of history? There's quite a few to choose from, admittedly.
There is quite a few. I'm thinking. Which bitch I want to choose.
Yes.
I would say Sarah Palin.
Ooh. That's like, because most people go Cheney on that, but I like Sarah Palin.
Yeah.
Why Sarah Palin?
I think Sarah Palin set women back to the dark ages with her mentality.
Yeah.
I think her mentality was... And her lack of knowledge and finesse set women back to the dark ages.
Yeah, and you think about it too. I'll go with this. I'll close the loop. I think she was the avant garde. She laid the groundwork for Trump. Because I remember, you know, you think in 2008 that election, a worldview was dead. And I was at a baby shower, I think it was, or a christening party, or something. Or maybe it was a wedding shower, something, in Altoona, Pennsylvania, in God's country, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
That Saturday, that, you know, was the morning she was announced. And I guarantee you, the people there could not have told you who the governor of Alaska was Friday night. And for some reason, Saturday morning, we're talking about this brave, bold new choice for a new America. And that was just identity politics.
Wow.
With no substance. It was just this feeling of this kind of great white hope mm-hmm. iconography.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sarah Palin was the avant-garde. She was the first wave over the top. And now that's the Trump voter right there. And yeah. So there it is. Sarah Palin did it first. Yeah. But maybe didn't do it best. I don't know.
Good point. Yeah. You know, and it gave this aura, even with Obama being president, to the powerful white men. Anybody could be president. A black man could be president. Anybody yeah. could be president. You
George
know?
W. Bush was president.
Yeah, anybody could be well.
A B-movie actor was president.
Yeah.
Bedtime for Bonzo, the guy who starred Bedtime for Bonzo was president, you know. Fundamentally changed my life and the course of almost everyone's life on the planet.
Yeah, for sure.
Imagine if he got the role for Casablanca instead of Humphrey Bogart. How would history have been?
And how people just lift him up as this great American hero. Because
it's a myth. It's an idea. It's an image. People think in images. He was grandpa. He was America's grandpa. He had jelly beans right there on his desk.
He probably threw them at people.
Probably did on the floor in the office. Well, on that happy note, I think that's about it.
It's been fantastic.
Thank you for coming. Thank you. I always appreciate everyone who does this, and because we get to have these kind of special, meaningful conversations that we can share with the world. Speaking of which, our next episode will eventually happen, and it'll be about something. I think we'll be back to our regular punk rock programming, I think. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. And again, we'll have the links on the website to where to get this great book, Know Thyself, An African-American Poetic Journey by Desi Bay. Thank you so much for doing this. And thanks to Brett, as always, for the lovely theme music. Later, meets.
Yeah, thank you, Matt. It's been my pleasure.
Oh, you're welcome. This was good.